Jeremy Renner returns to Paramount Plus for a brand new season of the original hit series, Mayor of Kingstown.
My job is to create a balance, avoid a war.
From executive producer Taylor Sheridan, co-creator of Yellowstone.
There's some new players in town, and they brought the plague.
And Antoine Fuqua, director of Training Day.
I know it's always been a war zone, Mike, but this is next level.
The mayor is back in business.
Are you warning me? You're going to find out.
Mayor of Kingstown. New season streaming June 2nd. Exclusively on Paramount Plus.
Showtime Sports presents Showtime Boxing with Eric Raskin and Kieran Mulvaney.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Showtime Boxing with Raskin and Mulvaney. I am Kieran Mulvaney and I am joined by my co-host with a background in boxing, journalism, podcasting, and everything that is outrageously washed, Eric Raskin. Eric, when I was attending a lot of fight weeks and a lot of weigh-ins, I would frequently joke about the fact that my daddy would be super proud of the fact that I was earning my money from watching young men with 0% body fat strip to their underwear and step on scales. And, well, Dad's been gone for 13 years now, and honestly, I don't think I would even know how to begin telling him how I spent this Sunday night or why. I think as soon as I uttered the words YouTuber, he'd be lost. Yes, we are coming at you right after Sunday's pay-per-view event, headlined by the 8-round exhibition between Floyd Mayweather and Logan Paul. We're going to talk about that card. Later on, we're also going to address some news in boxing, and I am going to run down my list of top 5 fights that make the case for Miguel Cotto Hall of Famer. But first, let's get right to it. Let's talk about this highly unconventional card on Showtime pay-per-view. Let's begin with the main event. Eric, if you will, let me start by saying, if I may, honestly, I got to give some props to Logan Paul. He got himself in incredible shape. He knew there was every chance that Floyd would whoop him if he wanted to, but he hung in there. He threw some punches. He took some punches. And yes, Floyd appeared to be half-assing it, and his timing seemed to be off. And he is 44 years old and 30 pounds lighter than Logan Paul, but still, I would have been out cold after 6 seconds. and I liked his attitude, Logan Paul's. I liked his whole, you know what, this is ridiculous, life is crazy, what the hell am I doing here kind of vibe. And I think his brother seems to be an obnoxious little shit, but I found myself quite warming to Logan Paul.
Oh, no. A new Logan Paul fan has been born.
I didn't say that.
You just became officially the world's oldest Logan Paul fan, if you are a Logan Paul fan.
I didn't say I was a Logan Paul fan.
All right, you're accepting of Logan Paul to some degree.
Indeed, within the right context.
Okay. I guess I would sum it up with what Floyd said after the fight. He's better than I thought he was. I think that's fair to say. He was competent, Logan Paul. We'll be talking in a few minutes, I'm sure, about Chad Ochocinco or Chad Johnson, whichever name you choose to use for him. Relative to a boxer like that, You can see there's a huge difference in what Logan Paul brought to the table. This was basically kind of a real fight. It was a weird fight. It was a physical mismatch and an experience mismatch in the opposite direction. It was not a standard boxing match, but it did resemble a boxing match, and there were strategies being employed, and there were some swings of momentum. It was like the first 2 rounds I gave them both to Logan Paul because Indeed. He was outworking Floyd, who was as they say, downloading, gathering information, deciding when Paul was tired enough for him to attack. And then around the 3rd round, Floyd started doing that. And so I guess it was a tale of sort of 3 fights. First 2 rounds, Floyd not doing much. Logan Paul, much like Conor McGregor in the early rounds, appearing to have success that wasn't really success. Then you had rounds 3, 4, 5, kind of fun. I was surprised how entertained I was watching Mayweather start to do his thing offensively as Logan Paul got more and more tired. And then you had rounds 6 through 8 when they just sort of settled into a rut of lots of holding and Floyd was no longer pushing so hard to do much damage and you were just kind of rooting for it to be over. That was sort of the sequence of events for me. I went, but those middle rounds, just as Floyd said of Logan Paul, he's better than I thought he was. Those middle rounds, the fight was more entertaining than I thought it would be.
Yeah, and following on from that comment, I'm going to leap straight to, actually, we've got a few tweets of the week. They're all basically the same thing. And there's a sequence from our good friend, he doesn't know that he's our good friend, but we like him, Brandon Lee, who started off by tweeting, 0-1 versus 50-0, LOL. Then he followed with like a couple of updates, like, oh, here we go, right, Mayweather's about to like throw some punches now. And then he finished with, all right, I'm over it. With about two rounds still to go. And then there was another tweet from somebody I don't know, but was retweeted into my timeline, from Grabaka _Hitman. If Floyd isn't going to brutally KO his hilariously overmatched opponents, I don't see the point in these things. And, you know, part of me was a little pissed at Floyd for like letting him last the eight rounds, because I'm like, oh, this is just going to encourage all of them. They're all going to come out of the woodwork now. But I did also wonder, and I don't want us to like overanalyze this, but I did also wonder, at first I thought, oh, well, maybe this is just Floyd, he's doing it again, right? Like, never, you can never overestimate the degree of cynicism about Floyd Mayweather. And I'm like, he's got his money, he's just in there to move around the ring, he's not going to try and do anything. But then I also thought, and especially listening to him talk, I thought, even watching him, he was missing some punches. And I thought, maybe age is catching up to Floyd Mayweather a little bit. His timing looked a little bit off, and maybe he did actually want to slap him around a bit more and found that he couldn't. Again, don't want to overanalyze this, but these are the thoughts that went through my head.
We are podcasters. Overanalyzing is kind of part of the job description, especially with a fight like this. You know, we're supposed to try to read something into it here and figure out something to talk about with this, which is certainly not the usual serious boxing match that we analyze an appropriate amount. We kind of have to overanalyze this to some extent. And I have the same questions that you do about Floyd. Could he have done more? I'm not so sure he could have. He is a remarkable athlete for a 44-year-old. Yes. Not that far removed from the last couple times that we saw him in an exhibition fight or a Conor McGregor fight, which was sort of half an exhibition. He's not washed. Like, I wouldn't say that if you put him in with a good young fighter, he has no chance. He didn't look like that to me, but he's clearly not what he once was. And you're right, the timing wasn't quite there. But also, he's in with a guy 30-something pounds heavier than him. It might be that no matter how many times he hits him flush, as long as Logan Paul was in good enough shape to not get completely exhausted, which I guess turned out to be the case. It seemed he was getting on his way toward complete exhaustion, but it never quite got past that point of no return, and he hung in there and managed to go the eight rounds. I don't know if there's much that this version of Floyd could have done to stop a competent 190-something pound fighter like Logan Paul. So I don't really look at this as I'm disappointed in Floyd for not stepping on the gas. Paul was holding him a lot down the stretch, and I'm not sure there was much more Floyd could have done to get him out of there. I was going to ask you how you thought Floyd looked compared to the last couple of times that we saw him. And it seems like you're focusing on that the timing wasn't quite there. It's going to be diminishing returns the more he keeps, if he continues doing this, which Brian Custer was asking him about afterwards, and he didn't quite give a clear answer. At some point, I think this fight shows you that at some point, the right mediocre opponent might be too much for him. But he's not there yet. He's still got enough left to look in total control against a guy like this, I think was the key. Yeah. I never sensed that Floyd was worried in the least that he wasn't going to be able to get through these eight rounds and pretty much do what he wanted to.
Oh, no, absolutely. He was obviously completely comfortable in there. I think it was just a question of whether he would have liked to have done more. And Floyd, among many other things, is smart. And Mike, you know, you talked about, you know, whether he would do this again, and he didn't quite answer that. There's certainly that cynicism in him that, my God, if somebody's going to throw money at him to just walk around the ring and not get hit by a guy, he's up for it. But at the same time, he's got that pride, I think. And I think that if he feels, God damn, I didn't quite have it in there, he's probably not going to take the risk of embarrassing himself, would be my guess. And if he's going to do an exhibition again, it might be a Big Show rematch or something like that.
Yeah. It seems, especially if he is successfully holding on to his money, which by all accounts he is. I haven't heard anything about him being in any trouble in that regard. I sense that he's doing this more for a desire for the spotlight, and even even maybe a little bit of a desire to just get in the ring. Rather than, you know, the reported $50 million plus that he's making for this. I don't think he needs that, and I don't think that is what keeps him coming back. I think it's sort of like the situation intrigues him, the attention intrigues him, and so if another fight comes along where those things are in line, he might do it. But yeah, I'd be curious if he'll like sort of watch this back and say, boy, I don't really like watching that guy in there who is a B-level version of the Floyd Mayweather that people remember. Maybe I don't want to show them that anymore. But, you know, I don't know that it's important to anyone what this does to his stock or anyone's image of him. I do want to ask you, though, the impact of this just on the sport of boxing, because it's something we've danced around and talked about a little bit leading up to this. I saw some mention on Twitter of where it just felt like people who didn't enjoy this were holding it against boxing. And to me, that's like saying that because the NBA All-Star Game sucks every year because nobody plays any defense, that means the NBA sucks. And it, they obviously don't really view it that way. But it do you think that's just like in the moment people are a little frustrated, they didn't see the knockout or they didn't see the Floyd they were looking for, and that will go away and by tomorrow nobody will be talking about that this fight proves boxing is dead or anything like that?
I think that's exactly it. I think that everybody fully expected Floyd, when he decided he wanted to knock him out. I did. and that didn't happen. And I think there's that sense of, I think perhaps the people who are saying that were hoping, a little bit as I was, that Floyd would kind of smack him around, make him look really stupid, and it would kind of put a little bit of a halt on this whole, hey man, I'm in good shape, I can go and be a boxer kind of thing. And in fact, I think probably the exact opposite has happened. And now it's like, oh my god, Logan Paul went 8 rounds with Floyd Mayweather, just think what I could do with a bit of training. And I don't think we have seen, I think it will encourage this kind of thing to keep going. And whether you feel that's a black mark on boxing or just a natural extension of the carnival barker that has been boxing over the last 100 years or so, isn't really, you know, up to you.
Yeah, they did a good job on the broadcast reminding viewers that the exhibition bout featuring the retired boxer is nothing new. This has been going on for as long as boxing has existed.
Indeed. Exactly. There were a couple of real fights on the card, but before we get to them, there was one other exhibition as well. You've touched on it already. Former NFL wide receiver Chad Ochocinco-Johnson surviving a knockdown against Brian Maxwell to go for 2-minute rounds. Maxwell apparently is a professional fighter of sorts. Apparently he's 0-3 as a bare-knuckle fighter and 0-1 as a boxer. And honestly, that record probably flattered him a little bit from what I saw in there. But however, then when he scored that knockdown, he promptly touched gloves and made little to no effort to do anything else, at which point I was fully aware, and perhaps should have been before, that Maxwell's job in there was to just not embarrass Chad Ochocinco-Johnson. Is that the feeling you came away with as well?
Yeah, whether it was sort of his unspoken job in there or it was just the way that he felt personally that he didn't want to embarrass the guy and hurt the guy, I'm not sure which it was guiding him. But yes, when he scored that knockdown, which honestly the fight was... not that I was scoring it carefully and they were 2-minute rounds and all that, but it was neither guy had clearly established superiority in the fight prior to that knockdown. I would say that knockdown established that, okay, Maxwell is the guy here. And so then, yeah, when he went into touch gloves mode after a knockdown, I've never seen that before. I know it's an exhibition, but I was not expecting that. And yeah, that's what it said to me, that he just does not want to knock Johnson out. That knockdown gives him the bragging rights that he's looking for to claim that he, quote unquote, won the fight. And that's all that he needed out of this. But again, there's a real gulf between a guy like Ochocinco-Johnson trying boxing and what he looks like doing it, how uncomfortable he is in there, how bad his technique is. He was trying hard. But, you know, was tiring by the second round, and these were 2-minute rounds. Just the punching technique was terrible. The difference between him and a Logan Paul is really striking. And then, of course, there's still the difference from a Logan Paul to a real cruiserweight fighter right. and what they look like. So, you know, it was sort of interesting to just put it all on display for some casual fans and see these various levels of it here. If we're talking about overanalyzing, I feel like we may have already gone on too long for the Chad Ochocinco Brian Maxwell fight. But
yeah,
and although we didn't mention the great line from Chad Johnson that he lost his virginity tonight, so there's and he thinks he's ready for Conor McGregor.
Yeah,
I'm not ready for that, but he might be.
I really was starting to like the fact that he said in advance that he didn't want to be anything that he isn't, that this was basically a bucket list item, and that his main goal going in was to not embarrass the people who had worked with him and trained him. And I thought, you know what? That's fantastic. Good for you. I'm fully appreciative. And I thought, you know what? Okay, your technique's horrible, but you know what? For a 43-year-old complete novice, good on you. And then he went and said that, and that was the end of my feels about that. So there you go.
Okay.
All right, we had a couple of real fights.
We did.
Although one of them, was it really a real fight? Badou Jack was scheduled to face Jean Pascal for a light heavyweight belt in a rematch of a fight that Jack felt sure he'd won. But if Badou Jack didn't have bad luck, he wouldn't have any luck at all. And as we've discussed, and we'll talk a little bit about later, that went out the window when Pascal tested positive for every PED known to humanity. Jack found himself in against unbeaten but untested and honestly unworthy Dervin Kolina. Kolina was deducted the point in round two and another in round three for his Henry Akinwande tribute act.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jack knocked him down, I think it was three times in the end. I kind of started to lose count. Kolina, I thought that Kolina may have been trying to pull a wee bit of a Luis Santana at the end there. The way he rolled over theatrically and spat out his mouthpiece after Jack sunk a shot to his ribcage when he was already down.
Right.
But the referee wasn't buying it. To be fair to Kolina, he took this at very late notice. But did Badou Jack get anything out of this, or will he just be grateful for the exposure and the payday and the win?
I think the latter. I don't think he got anything out of this other than exposure, payday, another win on his record. You know, a little activity getting in the ring, but Kolina just wasn't on his level. I'm not sure who the 15 guys Kolina beat to build up that record, who they were, but
Ryan Maxwell, Chad Ochocinco,
could well be. Yeah, it's interesting about the way that it ended with that him sort of doing that act. Because there was apparently a 3 knockdown rule in effect, I guess you could say that the late punch. And it was a blatant punch when he had a knee or both knees on the canvas. I guess that it didn't count because the fight was already over
once
he touched down a third time.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if that's how the referee was interpreting it or if he just decided, I'm going to ignore this this extra punch. I actually thought it was over after the second knockdown, the way he went down from a good body shot. It looked like he wasn't going to get up, but then he did. I guess my main takeaway from this is that he was on his way to the Henry Akinwande disqualification loss for holding, and that would have been even uglier. I'm glad that Badou Jack knocked him out before he could get disqualified.
Yeah, I am too. I like Badou Jack. He's a good dude. And honestly, I'm happy for him to have an easy and early evening for once in his life.
Sure.
He deserves it. We've talked about this before. His list of opponents over the last few years has been ridiculous. And he's gotten very close losses or very close wins against all of those guys. It's been nothing has come easy for him. And so if he gets one early night, good for him at age 38. So
and we needed one fight to end inside the distance so that we could begin podcasting before midnight. So thank you for that, Badou.
Exactly. Checks in the mail. So because of that change in opponents, we didn't know that Kolina was the guy that he would be facing, we were not able to do an official prediction for that particular fight. There was one of the fights on the card, however, for which we were able to make predictions, and that was the middleweight 10-round special attraction between Jarrett Hurd and Luis Arias. And we both scored not 8 points or 5 points, but 0 points, as we both picked Hurd to win a unanimous decision. But in the event, Arias out-hustled him over 10 rounds, overcoming a bogus knockdown decision, but also perhaps escaping what could have been a last second knockdown to earn a split decision that really should have been a unanimous decision, I think. I said on our preview podcast, I thought that Hurd would look uncomfortable early with having been out of the ring for a while and having put on a lot of weight, but that he would steadily come on as Jarrett Hurd does in fights. He did indeed look uncomfortable early, but he also looked uncomfortable in most of the middle of the fight and again at the end of the fight. And despite occasional flashes, he never did turn it around. He never did produce that typical Jarrett Hurd kind of comeback. Was this a weight issue, an inactivity issue, or are Hurd's bad habits, his habit of taking punishment early and then just kind of walking down his opponent and beating him up late and not really having a defense, are those bad habits catching up to him?
Yeah, I don't think it's a weight issue. I don't imagine that that's really the problem. I know he had to lose a lot of weight to get ready for this fight, but I doubt that that is it. Inactivity, I could see maybe being a little bit more of a factor, but mostly I think it's the bad habits and the tough fights catching up to him. Every fight he's in, he takes punishment. And so at a certain point, that starts to catch up with you, and it's not so easy to just flip the switch, turn it on in the third round, fourth round, whenever you need to. And he had trouble doing that here. I'm not sure, you know, where he goes from here. And I don't want to take all the credit away from Luis Arias, who fought probably the best fight of his career. I don't mean to make it all about Jarrett Hurd, but that is kind of the instinct, is to say, what the hell happened to Jarrett Hurd? This is not the guy that we saw a couple of years ago who can, you know, give away the first couple of rounds and then really dazzle you and turn it on and outslug these guys. Here, he seemed to be turning it around in the middle rounds and then starting to take control. And then he just couldn't break through and finish it off and lost the last couple of rounds, other than that bad knockdown call that just served to make this look sort of close on the cards when really it wasn't even that close. Your prediction on this, even though we both got 0 points, your prediction was closer than mine. You at least suggested it was going to be a sort of a narrow escape for Hurd after he does come out and lose the first few rounds, as he tends to do. I thought he would win this one convincingly, just because my perception of Arias was as a guy who just can't get it done at this level.
Yep. And I was also ultimately far too dismissive of Luis Arias. And you're right, we actually need to give him credit for the fact that he came in here with a game plan, knowing exactly how Jarrett Hurd fights and turning that against him. And he made that work for him. And Luis Arias does deserve props for that. He absolutely came in with the right game plan. And yes, as you said, probably fought the best fight that he's fought at this level.
Yeah. And also, let's give him some credit for overcoming just a weird fight with lots of starts and stops, because, you know, there's rain blowing into the ring and he's slipping on the logos and they're calling timeouts. And certainly that wet logo from the rain was the reason that he suffered that official knockdown. Come on, someone's got to jump in the ring and pour the soda on the ring, the Jay Larkin technique. Come on. But yeah, I mean, he was just dealing with all sorts of distractions and issues, and then you're coming to the end of the fight with that bad knockdown call swinging at least 2 points away from him if you scored it 10-9 for Hurd, because you didn't totally buy the knockdown or you thought he lost the round otherwise. Possibly a three-point swing if you made it a 10-8 round for Hurd. It was just really unfair, and I was quite concerned that they were going to give the decision to the wrong guy. Let's tip our cap to the judges in Florida, who actually got this one right and gave it to the underdog, the non-house fighter, etc. Ultimately, I guess tip my cap to two of the three judges, since it was a split decision, but they got the right guy.
On May 23rd.
I want to go back to normal.
What's normal?
The Paramount Plus original series, Evil Returns.
We've already hunted werewolves and demons.
And now what? A baby antichrist?
Okie dokie.
Prepare yourself.
You will not beat us.
For the end.
I have visions of hell.
Make it stop. Make it shut up.
You're not gonna survive this.
Evil, the final season. Streaming May 23rd, only on Paramount Plus.
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. Are you still listening? Good. Take a deep breath. You needed a break. This Earth Week, you can live stream 7 national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. So, yes, you can literally stream a stream. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.
Indeed. All right. That will do it for that pay-per-view card. Let's move on. Not much else going on in the world of boxing either this weekend or next. We have one other fight to review and one to preview. In England this weekend, Daniel Dubois bounced back from having his orbital bone broken during defeat by Joe Joyce to smash Bogdan Dinu inside two rounds and move to 16-1 with 15 KOs. And next weekend, super featherweight contender Shakur Stevenson returns with a bout against Jeremiah Nakatila from Virgin Hotels, Las Vegas. Eric, any thoughts on either of those?
Yeah, I'll hit Dubois first, if I may quote myself from last week's podcast. I said, first fight back, I think he wants a KO1 or KO2 if he can get it. And probably he can. KO2 is my best guess here, end quote. So more important than a shout out to Daniel Dubois, shout out to me. Nailed the exact round.
I know that feeling. I know it well. It's a great feeling. You know, it's great. It's good that you've got like that starter of getting the correct round. It's really great when it means something.
I was just going to say, wasted it on a fight that doesn't count.
Yeah, but that's okay. You'll get there.
Yeah, I'll learn. actually, I can't say it didn't count because I did bet this one, sort of.
Ah, even better. Okay.
Although I didn't do the KO2 exactly bet. I wish I had, but I took a safer bet on the fight to go under 3.5 rounds at even money. That was kind of a bad line. I think the over-under should have been more like 2.5, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, not a lot to say about Dubois, except he looked like himself. He wasn't gun-shy. But I wouldn't expect him to be against Dinu, who presented zero danger, as we discussed beforehand. Beautiful right hand to finish it. And with that, by beating Dinu, Dubois claims a vacant interim quote-unquote world title in his first fight back off a stoppage defeat. The alphabet groups are a hoot, aren't they? as for the Stevenson fight, kind of the same old story with him. You know, one of the best young talents in the sport. Still waiting to see him in with a serious contender, someone in the legit top 10, someone who can test him a little. And I don't believe that's Nakatila, who's 21-1 with 21 wins against not a single opponent you've heard of. Now, Stevenson's just 23, so there's no huge rush, but he's clearly ready for anyone. Yeah. It would seem, you know, he wants the big opponents, but he's in these marking time fights. But at least he's been staying busy. And hopefully an Oscar Valdez or a Jermell Herring, someone on that level, is on the docket for him soon.
Yeah, he feels like he has the talent to be more than ready. There's no reason at this point, I feel, in his career with what he's shown us, other than, oh, these guys are busy and they've got to fight each other. And once the logjam's clear at the top, then he can get a shot. That's like the only reason for him not to be up there right now. I think he merits being up at that level, doesn't he? I don't think he needs to be protected very much anymore.
No. And the question is whether he's got a little bit of that problem of he's not really worth a lot of money to these guys.
Right.
And he's obviously very talented. So maybe not that they're ducking him, but maybe they're not in a big rush to fight him either.
Yeah.
All right, time for some outside the ring news. And while there aren't too many items this week, our main event combines two developments that are significant for the boxing watching audience on both sides of the Atlantic. In the UK, Matchroom Boxing confirmed a story that had already been unofficially revealed a few weeks ago, that it has signed a 5-year deal for its UK boxing events to be streamed exclusively on DAZN, a deal that replaces Matchroom's longstanding partnership with Sky Sports. One key detail: as previously reported, Anthony Joshua and Dillian White have separate deals that may see them remain on Sky. And here in the States, Hall of Fame blow-by-blow announcer Jim Lampley, long affiliated with some minor cable network that isn't Showtime, is returning to ringside. He has signed a deal to call events for the somewhat unconventional Upstart Network Triller, beginning with the June 19th pay-per-view event headlined by Teofimo Lopez versus George Kambosos. Kieran, thoughts on these developments on the broadcasting side of the sport?
Yeah, look, as you mentioned, we touched on that Matchroom DAZN Sky News deal when it first came out a month or so ago. But yeah, look, this is huge, and not just in the UK, really. I mean, over there, you know, Sky and Matchroom have been joined at the hip over the last several years. Their partnership has really helped elevate boxing in the United Kingdom into the, once again, you know, mainstream kind of sport that it is over there. Adam Smith, Sky Sports boxing head and head commentator. He's been as much a part of the boxing soundtrack and landscape as Eddie Hearn in recent years. You wonder if Sky will remain committed to boxing, you know, beyond carrying Box Nation as part of its like channel offerings or not. I'm not sure if folks in the US truly get a sense of how massive Sky is in the UK and what a seismic event this is, but yeah, it could really shake things up. Not least because, you know, the way it has like broader ramifications is that, you know, potentially, okay, if folks want to keep their Sky Sports subscription, then DAZN is another expense. But, you know, to get a Sky Sports subscription, you've got to get the whole other Sky bundle package, and you've got to get a Sky receiver and all of this. And if there are people who didn't actually want to go through all that expense, you know, maybe boxing is going to be yet more accessible over there now as a result, which could be really interesting. And that's why it's a broader significant issue, because it's probably the biggest shot fired, I would say, so far in the streaming versus linear or satellite broadcasting battle. And we might just get more of a sense, depending on how this works, as to how that whole thing is going to shake up over the coming years. And as for Lampley and Triller, like, another sign really that things are still sort of looking to shake themselves up and how the whole broadcast network is going to work out, landscape is going to work out for boxing. Look, boxing needs Jim back behind the microphone. He's a phenomenal blow-by-blow announcer. We miss having him there. It will be fantastic to hear him again. And I certainly don't blame Triller for throwing money at him. I don't blame Jim either, who's been biding his time teaching courses at his alma mater in North Carolina, for leaping at the opportunity. I worry a little bit about the environment in which he's coming back. I mean, look, obviously Triller is trying to do something very different, and that's fine. But as you and I have talked about, I don't know that what they're doing necessarily works super well for, say, yours and my demographic, and that may well hold even more for Jim's. I felt a bit bad for our buddy Al Bernstein when he was doing color on their last broadcast and seemed incredibly out of place. Obviously, Jim's been brought on to be lead broadcaster, but I hope that this signifies that maybe they're thinking, okay, this time we've got a serious boxing event as our main event, so maybe we need to tweak it a little bit more so we do still appeal to the hardcore boxing fans and we're not just doing this thing, because otherwise I think that's a waste of Jim. It might not be a very good fit for Jim. I would hate to see him in that sort of awkward situation again where he thinks to himself, oh my God, what the hell am I doing? So I'm curious to see whether this is going to lead to a slightly tweaked direction for Triller, who are obviously still trying out and trying to see exactly what it is that they can do to be different and successful in this market.
Yeah, and when you were just starting there, you said something to the effect of looking forward to seeing Jim back behind the microphone, and I swear in my head for a second I heard looking forward to seeing Jim Bag behind the microphone, and I was like, interesting take, but sure, why not?
No one has ever said that. Except possibly Jim Bag.
Right. Only fictional people speak of Jim Bag that way.
That's right. Exactly. All right. A few items on the news undercard. Showtime has signed a multi-fight deal with Jake Paul beginning in August with an event against former UFC champion Tyron Woodley, who is now 39 years old, has not won an MMA fight in 3 years, and has never boxed professionally. But clearly, Jake Paul and his people are, among other things, outstanding. Outstandingly good matchmakers early in his career. Talks are underway, Dan Rafio reporting, for a possible light heavyweight clash between Joe Smith Jr. and former middleweight titleist Daniel Jacobs. As we're recording this, I don't think it's been confirmed, but there have been lots of reports that Maciej Czuleski may have pulled out of his scheduled June 19th bout with Jaime Munguia, and Jean Pascal, who was scheduled to fight Badou Jack on Sunday night's Mayweather pull card, but was removed after testing positive for 3 PEDs, has tested positive for a 4th EPO, which is a lot harder to explain away and blame on your strength and conditioning coach. Eric, thoughts on any or all of the above there?
Yeah, I'll hit them all. Go in reverse order of how you presented them. Pascal, my rule is 3 PEDs can be a coincidence. 4 is where I start to suspect something is fishy. But seriously, this doesn't really change the story at all. If we found out now that there was actually one more body in Jeffrey Dahmer's freezer, it doesn't really shake up the narrative. Munguia Suletsky, man, Munguia just can't catch a break here.
I know.
Very mysterious the way Suletsky is reportedly pulling out, but giving no reason why. We'll keep an eye on that. I assume they'll find somebody for Munguia to fight. Smith Jacobs, I like that. Even though he's given up some size, I think I would make Jacobs the favorite there, but it's a very competitive fight on paper. And Jake Paul versus the latest aging MMA fighter. Paul has found a lane that's working, so he's sticking with it. And it's showtime. As we've discussed, it's for a different audience than this podcast is primarily for, so I'm not sure how much time in the weeks ahead we're going to spend talking about this Jake Paul fight. But our friend Patrick Connor had a tweet about this that I thought pretty well hit the nail on the head. He wrote, "Not really my thing, though I'll probably watch, but in the context of larger boxing conversation, had it taken up a Showtime boxing slot, maybe there'd be more sense to the outrage. As is, I guess let its success or lack thereof speak for itself, buy or don't." Well said there, Patrick. I have nothing to add, really. It's not taking up a Showtime date or Showtime money that could have gone to other fighters. It's on pay-per-view. As Patrick said, buy or don't.
Yes, I've never really quite grasped that line of argument, which is, God, this is a terrible fight. And B, I can't believe it's on pay-per-view, which crops up every so often.
Right.
And that is say what you want about pay-per-view, and there's lots to be said against it. You buy it or you don't. And that's the way it is. So there you go. There wouldn't be a pay-per-view event if Jake Paul wasn't involved. So there you go.
True.
All righty. Top five list time.
Yes.
And it is my... You're excited about this. Oh, dear. Don't get too excited. It's my turn to answer the challenge set down for me last week by Eric. It is the ultimate dreamy challenge for someone like me, or indeed specifically me, as Eric noted. Miguel Cotto just missed out on being inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame at the first time of asking. So, Eric, you asked me, as the official life president of the highly unofficial Miguel Cotto fan club, to provide the top five list of Miguel Cotto fights that I would present to somebody who didn't know anything about him to make his Hall of Fame case. I joked that it might have to be a top 40 list, but you'll be pleased.
I think
to know.
You said top 47 or however many wins he has.
Apparently including all his losses as well. But you'll be pleased to know that that isn't what I've produced. I have, however, decided to cheat right out of the gate, because I figure if I can't cheat with this topic, when can I cheat?
Okay.
So, the specific way in which I'm cheating is that my number five is a three-way tie of bouts.
Ugh.
So whatever you... I'm pleased to see that you've taken that in the spirit I was anticipating.
I guess it could have been a 36-way tie or whatever.
It could have been.
Every fight in there, so I should appreciate that you limited yourself to only a three-way tie.
That was plan B. And it came during a period when Cotto was establishing himself as a bona fide championship level fighter. And these three, I put them together partly because they all have a strong personal element to them. I saw him face three undefeated opponents, two of whom had gotten the better of him in the amateurs and hand them a pretty fierce beatings. The first, September 11th, 2004, saw him stop Kelson Pinto, who was 2-0 against him as an amateur, in the sixth round after methodically breaking him down, knocking him down at the end of the fifth and then again at the beginning of the sixth. The second, on June 11th, 2005, was against the last man to defeat him as an amateur, Muhammad Abdullayev, who beat him in the Olympics and then went on to win the gold, but was no match for him as a professional, as Cotto hammered him, closing his eye and stopping him in the ninth. And the third, against fellow Puerto Rican Carlos Quintana on December 2nd, 2006, saw Quintana retire on his stool after a body shot. No particular one of these three necessarily elevates itself against the others, but the reason I put them all together is that taken together, they show just what an impressive, while impassive, fighting force he was during, you know, what might be called his phase one as a championship level boxer. This was classic Cotto, these three fights. Chin tucked, head forward, bouncing on his toes, working steadily behind a stiff left jab, and that crippling left hook to head and body. Like I said, classic Cotto, not speaking much English, rarely publicly smiling, steady and compact in his work, almost metronomic, until suddenly seeing an opportunity and then exploding into conclusive and concussive action. These were the fights that I would say, this is why, as he was coming up and establishing himself, a lot of people, including myself, fell in love with Miguel Cotto.
You call it classic Kodo. I call it classic Mulvaney. I try to tee you up with the easiest possible top five list I can give you, and you find a way to complain that it's not easy enough for you. And,
yep.
And actually, now that I see what the three are, I'm even a little more annoyed, because to me, one of these does clearly stand out from the others for me. Pinto and Abdullayev were both among my list of also-rans that mm-hmm. would have gone somewhere in the honorable mentions. Quintana is a top fiver for me. Maybe I'm a little biased because I was at that fight, and there are only a handful of Miguel Cotto's big wins that I was at. That was one, I believe that was in Atlantic City, if I'm remembering right. To me, that was... Quintana was not the best opponent on Cotto's record, but he was a very good one who was well-regarded at the time. And it was one of Cotto's most complete and dominant performances against someone around that level. So for me, that one was in the top five. The other two are not quite.
Okay, fair enough. But it's my list, so there you go.
Are there any more ties, or do we have
fair enough.
Just four
fair
remaining
enough.
Fights? Okay, good.
Yes, exactly. Number four. So in amidst those three fights, he was scoring other victories against guys like Chop Chop Corley and Randall Bailey, against then unbeaten Paulie Malignaggi. But... his September 24th, 2005 meeting with Ricardo Torres was the first time we saw him have to dig deep, find himself in real trouble, and have to fight his way back to victory. Torres was never one of the greatest fighters of his era, but he was always one of the hardest hitting, and his fights were frequently all-out brawls. But in the first round, Cotto was Cotto, calm, impassive, dropping Torres with a really nice short left hook. But the first sign of danger came late in the first when a Torres right hand splayed Cotto's legs a little bit. And then early in the second, Torres attacked and had Cotto in all kinds of problems for the first 2 minutes and change of that round until he finally put him down. Somehow, Cotto was the one who actually finished the round a little bit stronger, and he won the third. In the fourth, he put Torres down with a body shot. Then Torres came roaring back again in the fifth, and Cotto was needed to sort of find that reservoir again. Which he did, dropping Torres in the sixth, and again one last time in the seventh, Torres unable to beat that count. He pretty much had things his own way, Cotto, in his professional career up until this point. This showed us that he could be hurt, which was interesting, but also that he had the wherewithal to fight his way back to victory. And this was really the fight, I think, that marked Cotto down as an entertainer in the ring, as well as a very good technician.
Yeah, there's sort of a glass half full, glass half empty, different ways of looking at this fight that maybe the most thrilling fight of his entire career, certainly the fight in which he showed Hall of Fame heart. You could look at it the other way, though, and say Ricardo Torres was a good fighter, a dangerous fighter, not a great fighter, and Cotto had to go to hell and back to beat him, that it's a bit of a mark against Cotto in terms of whether he was truly a Hall of Famer in terms of skill and ability, the fact that he struggled this much with Ricardo Torres. But also, you know, a big puncher catches you. It can happen to anyone, and he did gut it out and come back. This was also in my top five, despite sort of the mixed feelings about it. This would have been my number five with Quintana just ahead of it at number four for me. But yeah, in terms of entertainment value, this just might be number one for Cotto.
Indeed. My top three, spoiler alert, are all from one location, because any accounting of Cotto's greatest hits has to include his residency at the world's most famous arena, Madison Square Garden. And coming in at number three, June 9th, 2007, TKO 11 over Zab Judah. It came just as he was really, I think, building to his peak. Cotto at this point was peak Cotto, I think, and he was beginning to establish a body of work and a way of working in the ring, was beginning to make it feel as if this was a guy who could be on his way to the very top of the pound-for-pound rankings. Of course, within a year, he'd come up against Antonio Margarito and perhaps Margarito's tainted gloves, and it got derailed for a while. But this win over Judah, I thought it was skillful, it was powerful, it was exciting, and it was in front of a packed and extremely loud Madison Square Garden crowd that would become something of a trademark of much of Cotto's career down the stretch. Judah started pretty well as Cotto adjusted to his hand speed and southpaw stance. But at this stage in his career, Judah tended to start pretty well and then not necessarily finish very well. The Puerto Rican really began breaking him down around round four. Round eight saw him seemingly on the verge of a stoppage. Round nine saw Judah take a knee in the corner. Round 11 saw the referee finally step in. This was exciting. but ultimately just a very impressive and dominating performance by Miguel Cotto. I thought this was the epitome of Cotto at his destructive peak, I think.
So I was part of that very loud crowd at the Garden that night, although I was trying my best not to be too loud as I was sitting on press row. But this is an interesting one in terms of how to regard it. Obviously, Judo was another very good fighter, not quite great, certainly higher talent level than a Torres type. My recollection is that Cotto struggled a little more in this fight than I expected him to, even though he did come through, and also that he got away with some low blows that helped him turn the fight around. So while I won't object to this being in the top five, I see the case for it. It wasn't quite a top five for me. To me, this was one where he was ready to grab the torch and become one of boxing's headline superstars and came up a little short of my expectations that night. Although, again, on the record, you look at KO 11 Zab Judah. It is certainly a strong win in terms of just putting it on his resume.
All right. We return to the Garden for number two. There are asterisks of sorts on both number two and number one, but still. The date here, June 7th, 2014, is the last of his fights on the list. It is officially KO 10 Sergio Martinez. And yes, there's obviously one very big caveat here, that Martinez was, to put it mildly, a wee bit gimpy at this point. He was 38 years old. He'd had some knee surgeries and he wore these very long trunks to try and hide the fact that he had strapping on both knees. But all you can do is beat the guy in front of you. Martinez had been the lineal middleweight champ when he faced Cotto, who, let us not forget, had begun his career at 140 pounds and was making his middleweight debut. Cotto and trainer Freddie Roach decided to test Martinez's mobility from the off and went at him in that classic Cotto style, never too wild, just stalking, coming forward, chin tucked, trying out that left hook that was really his singular punch of beauty. And of course, that left hook landing on Martinez's jaw early, wobbling him. Cotto then putting him down. Another left hook set up a second knockdown. Then he went down one more time before the end of the round, Martinez. He steadied himself a little bit thereafter. Cotto never panicked. He just kept at it, kept doing what he wanted to do, stalking him, moving around the ring, testing his mobility, looking to land that left hook, breaking through again in the ninth round. The referee incorrectly calling a knockdown, but clearly Martinez was pretty badly hurt and busted up at that point. And his corner keeping him on his stool as the bell rang to start round 10. Amazingly, Cotto's only lineal world title. Yes, there's a caveat. Yes, there's an asterisk. But it was still, given what he had to do and where he'd come from, I think an impressive performance by Miguel Cotto.
Yeah, you know, mentioning that asterisk, a big one on this fight. But one of the interesting things about Cotto's career, and we talked about this on the HBO podcast when he was still fighting, that he always lacked that totally defining, unimpeachable win over a Hall of Fame level fighter in that fighter's prime. The guys you've listed already, he beat a lot of very good fighters, fought a few truly great ones, but lost to those ones. Never had that absolute A-plus win, and that's why he's not a total slam dunk Hall of Famer. Yep. He'll get in, but there is a case for not voting for him, and this fight kind of encapsulates it, that you can put a big asterisk next to this, or you can look at it as he dominated the lineal middleweight champion, moving up in weight, technically came in as the underdog and stopped him and became the lineal middleweight champion. This is actually my number one, despite that giant asterisk. I think this is a great win, but even so, it does have that asterisk attached to it.
Yeah, he's one of those fighters where, you know, if you want to be an advocate, you can absolutely make the case, like you said, dominated and knocked out the lineal middleweight champ, for example. But if you don't want to be an advocate, if for whatever reason you're against him, there are plenty of asterisks to put up against his case. Like you said, lost to the very best and so on. And even his best wins tended to have a little bit of a caveat to him. The number one entry on my list is, for me, the definitive win of Miguel Cotto's career for multiple reasons. It's his TKO9 revenge over Antonio Margarito on December 3rd, 2011, again at Madison Square Garden. And lots of reasons for this, not least, this was as fevered a crowd as I've ever experienced. The more than 20,000 in the arena were overwhelmingly Puerto Rican, and they didn't just want a win, they wanted Margarito's head. after what had transpired between the two of them in the ring 3 years previously. I remember thinking as the main event began, I looked out at the crowd and I listened to the crowd. I thought, Kura doesn't win, I'm getting out of here. but it was never really in any doubt. This was the rarely cited spiteful Miguel Cotto. Ruthlessly and sadistically targeting Margarito's eye. And this is where the asterisk comes in for this fight. Probably Antonio Margarito shouldn't have been in the ring. He had to go through all kinds of top rank influence medical clearances after having had his orbital bone broken by Manny Pacquiao to even get in the ring. Cotto didn't care, especially after what may or may not have transpired in the ring between them beforehand. And he just absolutely targeted that eye ruthlessly, completely focused on it, had it closed by about round three or four. Margarito was mostly reduced to mugging and making faces and beckoning Cotto on. He claimed he was coming on at the end, but I really don't think he was particularly. You know, that first fight with Margarito had sent Cotto's career sideways for a little bit. This was the one that sort of enabled him to get back on his feet, to slay his white whale, if you will. And it was impressive. Cotto just settled into his comfort zone, had a target. That target was Margarito's eye. And he settled into a rhythm and he just stuck to it, pounding away, rarely dropping the mask until the very end when the fight was stopped. And he walked halfway across the ring just to stare Margarito down as he sat in the corner. Afterwards, fans were dancing in the street, waving Puerto Rico flags outside the fight hotel. It's another argument for his Hall of Fame case, just how immensely popular he was in Puerto Rico and what an immensely popular fighter he was in New York and at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, if he has a defining fight, it's either this or Sergio Martinez. It's kind of like which asterisk bothers you more and which one do you think of as his greatest triumph? One, the Martinez fight is more meaningful in the sense of claiming a lineal title. This one was more meaningful in every emotional sense imaginable and just what it meant to Miguel Cotto. Again, you know, it's another one of those where it's kind of like, did he slightly underachieve what maybe the expectations for him were going into this fight, given how compromised Margarito obviously was? He just doesn't have that perfect, unimpeachable win on his record.
Yep.
But as a look, I'm not the Miguel Cotto fan that you are, but I am a Miguel Cotto fan. And on this night, I feel like almost everyone had to be a Miguel Cotto fan. It was so clearly babyface versus heel in this one, and the babyface prevailed. And so it was very satisfying.
Yeah, and so a few in the honorable mentions category. One that I'm guessing you might have in your top five was his win over Shane Mosley.
Yep, that's the other one that's in my top five, yep.
Yeah, which you could certainly make the case was his best win, coming as it did against an opponent who's beaten him to the Hall of Fame. I have it slightly outside because I thought he was winning comfortably early and then allowed Mosley to come back into it before Cotto adjusted again, and I thought, you know, sealing it down the stretch. You could argue his middleweight defense knockout of Daniel Gill, his stoppage of a younger and then undefeated Yuri Foreman to win a 154-pound belt. And then for me, a personal favorite, his early-ish career fourth-round knockout of Victoriano Sosa in 2004. Sosa just gone the distance, actually, with Floyd Mayweather. This was the reason I put this on here. Partly, it's the first time I sat ringside for one of his fights. For a previous one, I'd been up in the bleachers. This was the first time I was in the press section. And that was the time that I thought, oh, my God, I just love this fight. Watching the way that he methodically and brutally just beat up and broke down Sosa. And Miguel actually told me many years later that was actually a pretty brutal fight, that Sosa was bleeding from his mouth really badly and he kept spitting blood in Cotto's face during that fight. As Ricky Hatton always said about boxing fights, they're not tickling contests.
They are not. Yeah, so the Mosley one, as I said, was in my top five because on paper, it's his best win. Just in terms of, yeah, beating a Hall of Fame fighter. Close, but I wouldn't quite call it controversial.
Right.
It was a little underwhelming in the sense that I recall Cotto basically did it with the jab and won a boxing match. It never quite opened up and showed all he could do in that fight, but he did enough to narrowly beat Shane Mosley before Shane Mosley was totally washed. So that to me is a top five win. I think you've mentioned pretty much everything else on my honorable mention list, except I would throw Justin Juco in there just because it was only Cotto's 10th fight. And he was taking on a guy at the world title challenger level in his 10th fight. And really, when you look at his whole resume, it's impressive how much he got done before that first Margarito fight that kind of derailed him. The first 7 years of his career, from age 20 to 27, it is just one quality name after another. Again, no A-plus name in there, but a lot of B-plus, A-minuses that he went through on his way to the top.
Yeah, I remember the fight week in Las Vegas for that first Margarito fight. I just sort of remember him doing a sit-down with some media, and I just remember thinking during that fight week, because I thoroughly expected him to beat Margarito. I thought he was just a different class of fighter. Mm-hmm. I really thought, based on what he'd done up to that point, I thought he was just going to go on and be one of the top pound-for-pound guys. And really, that first Margarito fight, he was never quite the same again. And it's certainly for those first couple of years afterwards, definitely, at best, sent him sideways, I think. That Cotto of 2005, 6, 7, he was a very, very impressive beast.
Yeah, and we'll never know, had what happened in that first fight against Margarito not happened, we'll never know if Miguel Cotto would still have zero tattoos today. That was what led him to start getting tattoos.
It was.
Once he started, he did not stop.
Yep, when you watch those early fights, that he has zero tattoos and head hair. It's a very different looking Miguel Cotto.
Yep.
All right, that will do it for another edition of Showtime Boxing with Raskin and Mulvaney. We will be back next week with two podcasts, a quickfire edition that will drop on Sunday night, in which the legendary Jackie Callan will join us to look back on episode 2 of the Showtime documentary series, The Kings. And then on Monday morning, we'll return with our regularly scheduled programming, featuring our preview of the June 19th Showtime Championship Boxing Show, headlined by Jermall Charlo against Juan Macias Montiel. Until then, thanks for listening. Be safe, be kind.
Now streaming on Paramount Plus. Gather your besties.
We are very exclusive.
And get ready.
Mom, go make snacks.
For sure, Regina. Yeah.
For the movie that hits like a bus. In a good way.
No one died.
Mean Girls.
Rated PG-13.
Now streaming on Paramount Plus.